Hello, and welcome to the Gaming with Science podcast, where we talk about the science behind some of your favorite games.
Today, we'll be talking about Stellar Horizons by Compass Games. All right, welcome back to Gaming with Science. This is Jason.
This is Brian.
This is Christoph.
So yes, we have our very first special guest host here, Christoph Wagner. Is it Wagner or Wagner?
Wagner is a German way to say it, and Wagner here in the States, that's fine.
For those of you who know the game, this is a game about near-Earth space exploration. Brian and I are plant biologists. We have no expertise here. So we wanted to get someone on who actually knew what they were talking about. So Christoph, tell us about yourself.
Sure. So I have a degree in physics and a master's degree in mechanical engineering and aerospace engineering. I'm originally come from Germany and did my mechanical engineering and physics in Germany, and then studied aerospace engineering at Purdue University with a major in astrodynamics, controls and guidance, navigation and control theory. Unfortunately, after I got done with that degree, I could not get a job in that field here in the US because of my German citizenship. And most of those jobs do require higher levels of security clearances. And so I ended up working at Caterpillar for 10 years.
Not involved in space exploration, obviously.
Not involved in space at all, unfortunately. But then through some, I got let go from Caterpillar in 2016, ended up in a company, a hydraulics company up in Minnesota, but that got way too cold for me, so I only lasted 2 years. And I took a job at Walt Disney Imagineering down here in Orlando. So I designed, or I was part of the ride team that designed the Guardians of the Galaxy Cosmic Rewind roller coaster at Epcot Center.
I just rode that. That's so much fun.
Yes, it is a lot of fun. And it was a lot of fun designing it too. But I was only a contractor. So when COVID hit, they let me go. And I was unemployed for a few months and obviously started looking. And I found this job that was essentially almost tailored for me at Kennedy Space Center, which is a fluid design engineer. So I applied. It took a while, but on October 2020, I started my position as a fluid design engineer at Kennedy Space Center. I work for a NASA contractor called Jacobs. And my main responsibility these days is that I'm a lead contract engineer for the hydraulic systems on the mobile launch tower for Artemis.
That's so very cool.
Yes, it's very cool to say that I am actually part of the Artemis team, and I have my little pin to prove it right here.
Oh, that's awesome.
So my biggest dream was always to work in the space-related field, and it took a while, but now I'm finally here, and I'm having a good time.
It sounds like you are super overqualified to talk about this game. I'm like us.
Well, I'll try not to use any fancy language here. Because the game does the same thing. I thought they did a fantastic job with how they try to relate progression and space development and space engineering to somebody who, you know, like you guys, have nothing to do with space. So I thought they did a wonderful job. I'll try and keep it at the same level.
All right. Sounds good. So before we dive into the game, I always like doing this fun science fact first. And Christoph, as our guest, you get first priority. Have you picked up any fun science facts lately?
Well, since we're talking about space, do you guys know why Mars is red?
Iron oxide?
Yeah, rust, iron oxide in
yes,
the soil,
exactly.
Or the regolith.
That's my science fun fact. Most people don't know that it's a rusty planet.
So where did all the oxygen come from that rusted out all the iron?
Eesh, good question. I'm not a geologist. That is, I mean, most of these planets, you know, they were formed many, 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 many billion years ago from solar dust. I'm just going to say I don't know.
Yeah, Brian, we have to respect the specialties of the people. He's a fluid engineer, and there are currently no fluids on Mars. So, sorry,
right.
A little bit
there
outside
might be.
The area.
As far as we know, we haven't found any. We have found some evidence, but we have not found any actual water or fluids yet.
Well, I found a science fact too, but now I want to talk about something different. I want to talk about how photosynthesis almost destroyed the world.
Oh.
No, photosynthesis was 3 episodes ago, Brian.
No. Not the game. The chemical process. So when photosynthesis developed, there was not a lot of free oxygen in the atmosphere. And as oxygen was poisonous to the majority of life and basically started to slowly build up. And actually, you can see there's these layers in the geological record of rusted out iron that happens periodically. And as oxygen built up in the atmosphere, it caused climate change that plunged the entire planet into like a giant snowball, almost presumably killed all life on Earth. But when eventually it came out the other side, now we have complex eukaryotic life. So something about the process, like, yes, photosynthesis almost destroyed life on the planet and completely rewired the ecosystem.
Hmm. I'm trying to come up with a witty response to that, and I'm having trouble. It's like, I don't think we're going to be quite so lucky if we almost destroy the planet this way. But yes, I've heard of the great oxygenation event and all the iron bands and everything.
Mm-hmm. My other thing was going to be the methane plumes on Mars, but I think we're good.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go into this game. So, Stellar Horizons by Compass Games, designed by Andrew Rader, who is also overqualified to design this game. So I looked him up. He has his PhD from MIT in like human space exploration. He works for SpaceX. He's published multiple children's books about space exploration. So this guy definitely has it down. Game itself, it's for 1 to 7 players, ages 14 up, which I will say that's probably accurate. This is a very complicated game. Playtime, some of the scenarios claim to be able to be played in 30 minutes. I have my doubts. The full campaign for experienced players is supposed to last 8 or more hours. This is a game. This is not a let's break it out during party time. This is something that you devote at least half of your Saturday to, sometimes even the whole weekend, depending if you've got the full 7-player spread going. As far as the game itself, it's very high quality. There's all sorts of pieces in there. There is so much game in this game. There is an 11-pound box with about 5 billion little components inside it. Which is only a little bit of an exaggeration. I actually looked at the parts list, and slide aside, this is the only parts list for a game I've ever seen that included the box as one of the components. So it's very thorough. And there are just over 1,700 individual components to this game.
Can I ask, did you time yourself when you were popping out all the tokens and how long it actually took?
I did not, because I was just doing it while watching my wife play video games. So it was just kind of taking advantage of the other side. It took a while. There were literally like 25 sheets of chipboard. Now they're high quality chipboard, very good game components. When I bought this, I said it was the most expensive and heaviest board game I have ever bought. It was like $130 at my local game store. Like I said, 11 pounds. Most of those bits are resources or other bookkeeping things. So like you've got your fuel, your money, your ore, you've got little faction markers to mark things up. So a lot of it is just bookkeeping stuff, which is just incidental to the game. The real core of the game is you have your planet tiles, which there's a dozen of those. So there's the 8 planets. There's also the asteroid belt, the Kuiper belt, even Alpha Centauri. There's 24 satellites /moons /dwarf planets. There's 7 different factions. Each of them has their board and about 30 individual units they have. They're all slightly different from each other. There's a big tech tree board. There's a policy board. There's player aids. There are mini rule books for each player to reference during the time. There is a lot of game in this game. There's a lot of components. There's a lot of moving parts. The impression I got while reading it is that it has the potential of being a very deep game. Like if you really sink the time in to understand this well, there's all sorts of different strategies and ways you can play it and such. There's a lot going on, but it is a lot. It is not for the faint of heart to get in. It is a very complicated game. Christoph, you said you looked over the rules. You didn't have a chance to play. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is a very, very complex game. I also felt that you can make it as complex as you want to. You can simplify it if you want to. There's options there, I think. I felt the base mechanics are not that hard. But the problem is you can put layers and layers and layers on top of that. That can make the game extremely complicated. For people that like that, it's, you know, like me, it was really well designed, I have to say, the way we did that. But yes, you do need... I don't even know if you can get an average teenager to play this game, because it does take some thought and patience and time to get into it.
We were talking about that and trying to figure out, like, who is this game for specifically? And it seems to be, just in terms of space, you need an enormous table to lay out to play the whole campaign, and you need to leave it there all day. I think there's a tradition of people playing Risk, where they will show up in the morning and they will play all day long. This is that game. This is, I can dedicate a huge amount of space and time and have a group of friends that will play this ridiculous game with me over the entirety of the campaign. It's Monopoly with an intensely more complication.
Yeah. So the genre this falls into, it's a 4X strategy game, where the 4Xs are explore, expand, exploit, and exterminate. where basically you are exploring things, you are expanding your territory, you are extracting resources, exploiting resources, and you are exterminating or combating other factions to try to take over. This is more famous in computer games. Civilization is probably the quintessential 4X game. There are some board games. Twilight Imperium is probably the most famous board game in this area. And so there's definitely people who really like this. Twilight Imperium is somewhere in the top 50, maybe the top 30 of board game geeks. So there's definitely a strong following for it. It's not necessarily what Brian and I tend to play a lot, but there's definitely a big market out there for it. And it's, as far as I can tell, this is a well-designed one. Speaking as someone who's not super experienced in this area, but it seems very well put together for that. As far as how playing the game works, you lay out the planets and all the satellites and everything. You lay out your faction board and your tech tree and things like that. And then there's different scenarios you can go through. So the default campaign is you basically start in 2030 and you play 150 years, which is literally 150 turns of near future space exploration, exploring worlds and launching probes and developing new technologies and eventually moving on to colonizing outer space and mining it and possibly fighting wars in it. And the end goal is that after that, in 2170, I think is when it ends, then you end and you count up all your victory points and whoever has the most victory points wins. There's also a bunch of other scenarios out there. So Brian and I played a much shorter scenario where there's an asteroid headed to Earth and you have 20 years to try to deflect it or shoot it to bits or whatever so that Earth does not get blown up. We played really poorly the first time, and so we just stopped halfway through because we knew the Earth was just going to get obliterated. So we started over again. And did much better the second time because we realized we could not explore the asteroid to death. It was not going to work. We just took guns up there and blew it apart and then towed it with some other stuff. And it worked much better that time.
We also realized that some of the resources that we were dependent on, it's like, oh, wait a second, look more carefully. You can only make fuel on Earth. If you're not able to shuttle or make it where you're going, like it was, we didn't understand the game that first time. Like in terms of that explore part, we were not exploiting correctly.
Yeah, and part of this is just there's a lot of rules to keep track of. I kept wishing I had a computer to keep track of all the little bookkeeping, the things like how much money I have, which level of the tech tree I'm at. So do my robots fail at a 27% rate or at a 24% rate? How often do my engines fail? These little things that are built in there. I mean, this is really, Brian, you like talking about the metaphor of the game. Mm-hmm. This game has no metaphor. It's like it's a simulationist game. You are playing a game about exploring space and you do it by exploring space. Like, that's it. It's like, there's no metaphor here at all.
Yeah, I blew the entire Russian space budget of $40 billion in 2 turns.
Yes, there's that. You only get money every 10 turns. So it does mean that you're kind of strapped by the end of it. So, but it does include all the little bits of space exploration, like your engines can fail. Your robots can just blow up at some point when you try to use them. If you have a crewed vehicle, there's a 50% chance they're going to have to come back every time you use them because something went wrong. Now, what I like is that every time something like that goes wrong, you actually get tech points representing that you're learning from your mistakes. Like, oh, our robot blew up. Well, now we know how to build better robots, so I get some tech points toward my next technology. Or, oh, we had to get our crew back because who knows what happened. It's like, well, now I get some biology points because now we know better how to keep people alive in space. It's like, I liked that. That was a nice consolation for things always blowing up. I did a little bit of solo play to try to figure out the rules, and the poor European Union could not get a satellite into space for the life of them. I rolled so many engine failures for those poor people. It's like every single satellite they spent tens of billions of dollars on these telescopes and probes and stuff, and they just blew up on the launch pad one after another after another.
I was so sad when the one ship I had just blew up. It blew up.
Yeah, and you know, that's very realistic right there. I mean, if you look at the development of the Apollo program, you know, going from Gemini and starting with the Gemini program and how many rockets they blew up before they were able to launch it successfully for the first time. You know, if you look in more younger history, if you look SpaceX and Blue Origin, those guys keep blowing up stuff. You may not always hear it in the news, but I mean, it took a while for them to have their first successful flight. And while in flight, for now, it's SpaceX, I think, has a pretty, you know, stellar record. We'll still have to see what happens to Blue Origin. I mean, they've had one failure with the human flight, right? But they got the humans back to Earth, no problem. I thought that whole scenario and how that was integrated into the game was really well done. The percentage, I mean, they work with percentages on how likely it is for your engine, yeah, and you have to roll for it. I tried to look into those percentages, but it's really hard to put a realistic number on that. If you look at human spaceflight, you know, if you look at the Apollo program, and there's only, during the entire Apollo program, there was only one set of astronauts that died, Grissom, Chaffee, and White with Apollo 1, but they only had not that many missions. So overall, I still think it was a massively successful program, obviously.
Yeah, I think the percentage for failure is about 5% on launch, and slightly lower if you're launching a crewed vehicle, because presumably we take more care when there's people involved, which probably would actually about fit with Apollo, to be honest.
Right. That, you know, it also depends on the launch vehicle, what kind of launch vehicle. The Soyuz is incredibly reliable, and that failure percentage is going to be really, really, really low, probably even below 5%. But they had to put some number on it. And my feeling is that they just looked at a few different programs and a few different rockets and came up with, used the big thumb and like, well, this looks good. Let's go down this way.
Yeah, and probably balance it with, we don't want to make this so high that it becomes unfun.
Right, because that's still the most important part of the game. It has to be fun to play.
Yep. So let's move on to some science stuff. So I was looking through this, and there's obviously a lot of science potentially in here. So space exploration, vehicle design, near-Earth astronomy. There is an actual deep space astronomy you can explore, but only with telescopes. It doesn't come in hugely. Most of it is within the solar system. Engineering, orbital mechanics. So they actually, there's different transit times to go from one planet to another that are roughly on par with how far they are apart in the solar system. Running a space program, a little bit of the economics of it. It is funny that the unit of currency is billions. You cannot have less than $1 billion, and nothing costs less than $1 billion. So yeah, so you've already talked about this a little bit, Christoph, but how does this reflect? As someone who's in the space program and in probably one of the premier space programs on the planet right now, how does this feel to you? Does it feel like an accurate representation?
Well, I would say it's very idealized. I mean, in reality, any space program you look like, they run over budget. So you can put a budget on it, and I don't think I saw anything where you have that mechanic in there where you overrun the budget. You always meet it, or you have to go under it, right?
I think they do. You can overrun your support limit. You can have more vehicles out there than you can pay for. And then you don't get all of your budget. You have to use some to support your ships. I don't know if that's exactly the same as what you mean. But yeah, you can be in debt based on the number of vehicles you have out there.
Yes, but only if you're there when the decade turns. So you can have them up till year 9.
Oh,
and then you just scrap them all and you don't have to pay for them come year 10.
Yeah, that... For non-reusable rockets, that may be true, but these days everything is going to reusable rockets, right? So you have a maintenance fee, maintenance cost. If you look at SpaceX, they have a whole science now devoted to looking at how to refurbish the rockets the most optimal, most quickest, and most cheapest way. And it's very, very interesting to see all that. Back in the day, they didn't even think of that stuff.
Yeah, which is actually an interesting part. So the part of the game is they have this big tech tree of all the near future technologies you can develop. And some of them are way out there, like antimatter reactors and fusion drives. But some of the early ones are some of them we already have. Like one of the very first ones is reusable launch vehicles, which I think only the United States starts off with. Technically, it's North America, the United States and Canada, but I'm pretty sure it's meant to be just the US. Anyway, North America starts off with the usable launch rockets in the full campaign. I don't think anyone else does. And the game implies that's one of the first ones most people are going to go for so that you stop just burning money every time you get something into space.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'm curious about, those launch rockets have a 75% chance of recovery, but a 25% chance of failure. Is that about on par with what we see with real reusable launch rockets?
I would have to dig a little deeper into this, but my first instinct is absolutely not. SpaceX has recovered all their rockets so far as I can tell.
Okay, so if they don't blow up on the launch pad, they actually get up into space, then we have a very good ability to get them back.
Right. It lands right. Some of them land right on the ocean on a redesigned oil platform, and then sometimes even land back at Kennedy Space Center, so you can see them come back. Yeah, but 25% failure seems awfully high.
Okay, so that may be one of the game mechanics they put in, just so you don't get free launch vehicles from then on out.
Right.
So probably to even up, because I mean, looking at the full campaign, you should not start the full campaign and then just play 20 or 30 years, because North America has a huge advantage to start with. The other factions are usually in there for the long game. It's like that's why most of the other scenarios, they start with a more even tech tree. But I think the campaign is meant to simulate roughly where we're going to be in about 10 years with some exceptions. So actually, this is probably a good time to talk about the factions, and you'd probably know a lot better how the various space programs around the world are. So there's seven factions. There's North America, which is the US and Canada. There's the European Union. There's China, Russia, Japan, Asia, which is sort of India, Pakistan, and a few other of the Middle East, Southern Asia countries. And then South America and Africa, which is essentially just the entire global South glommed together. And I was doing some research on this. I know some of these places have space programs currently, US, Russia, and China being the most advanced that I'm aware of. Europe has a bunch of satellite work, JAXA in Japan. How big are these players in the global scheme of things?
Well, right now, obviously, the biggest player is NASA. There's nothing bigger than that. Right now, some people like using old words again, like space race with Russia and China, because you can see that there seems to be some, I don't think it's been really confirmed yet, but that China and Russia are working together now on a space program and launching rockets. One thing you have to make clear these days, no country can run a space program all on its own anymore. Just not possible, not feasible. If you look at the NASA if you look at the Artemis program, there's the Artemis Accords where I want to say there's like 16 or 17 countries that signed onto it. And so they're all working together to land people back on the moon.
So what drives that? Is it the technology? Like you just need different aspects of technology? Is it the price? Like no one nation can actually afford this level of engineering. What is it that drives that level of collaboration?
Technology and sharing technology is definitely a small part of it, but the biggest part is the cost. You want to share the cost of landing the first man the first man after Apollo back on the moon. The economy involved is unbelievable. No country would want to carry all that burden on its own anymore these days. So you have, as I just mentioned, China and Russia that seem to be working together. Obviously, it's very hard to tell right now. But then on the Western civilization side, you have, China, JAXA, NASA, ESA that are working together. India is coming up really fast. They just landed their first probe on the moon not too long ago. That was also a story where they had, four or five failures and finally it worked out. So that's the next biggest player on the field. South America, you don't really hear too much about them. And I'm not sure we obviously have Latin American engineers that work at NASA. While I was thinking about this game, I realized something is somehow the people that originally were all involved in astronomy, the Egyptians, the Mexican, the Aztec culture, none of those are really spacefaring anymore. They started it somehow looking up into the stars, but these days have very little influence on what's going on anymore. Hopefully that will change. I'd love to see it change. I know that Mexico has its own space agency, for example.
Yeah, oddly, Mexico does not belong to any of the factions. So if you look at the launch trailer for the game, there's one spot where they show the world and they outline countries according to the faction, and Mexico just got left out in the cold, unfortunately.
Didn't even get included in North America for some reason.
Yeah, the Global South one, based on the flag, it looks like it's basically Brazil and friends. And I did look, Brazil has some sort of space agency. They obviously don't have their own launch capacity, but I think they do put up some satellites.
They have launched satellites in the past.
Okay, that's about the extent I know of that.
When Jason and I played our scenario, we worked as China and Russia and we worked together.
The time we won, we worked as China and Russia because I realized that Chinese ships in the game had more weaponry than the Global South ships that I was trying the first time around. There's only one ship of the Global South that actually has armaments to shoot an asteroid, unfortunately, and China had two or three, so I switched to them instead. I didn't check. Part of me suspects that the North America one may have the most guns of them all, but maybe that's just my own impression of how our country works.
Now, let me make one more comment here. If us space cadets that all work at these various space agencies around the world had our choice, we would get politics out of the way completely and just all work together.
I imagine. I imagine most of the people in the rank and file probably care more about the science and the goal of getting there than which country gets credit and who's jockeying with whom.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's get into this astronomy part of this now. So there's a lot of not just engineering, but also the astronomy. So there's all these different world cards, the planets of the entire solar system, and there's actually some nice science facts on them. So if you look on the fine print on each of the cards, it tells you its gravity rating. It'll tell you if it's a rocky or icy planet, a gas giant. It may have its astronomical unit distance from the sun. If not, I know the player inserts actually have a 2-scale showing of here's all the planets and the thing, and they actually have a little scale bar underneath. So they show you how far apart things are. I don't even know what the word for it is. An extraplanetary geologist? What is that? Exogeologist? Xenogeologist?
Yeah. Planetary geologist.
Planetary geologist. Okay. Not a planetary geologist. I don't know how accurate these are, other than they look kind of like what I understand. What's your thought of that, the game? So they have these different little bits of pieces. How accurate are they? Are they simplified? I'm trying to go, I don't know how to phrase this question.
Yeah. I looked into it a little bit. Obviously, I'm an engineer, not a geologist either. But from the little I could tell, it's very simplified to make it accessible to everybody. They also had to make some guesses, you know, because some of this was you have to have resources on certain planets to be that you need to be able to get to if you want to build a base and things like that. So I have a feeling they had to take some liberties here on what they can actually mine and get from a planet. But I don't know, a few years ago we had that. It's also a great book where they sent a human to Mars. I can't remember who was in it.
Is that The Martian?
The Martian, yes, exactly. If you read that book and look at and watch the movie, it is really well and very accurately done. There's some minor mistakes. I'm not going to go there right now, but you can just see what kind of effort it is to put somebody on Mars and make it habitable. So you need resources that the planet has to offer. So as I said, it looks like they may have taken some liberties there, just my broad sense.
So maybe there is a little bit of metaphor here. It's not a full simulation. There are approximations.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we haven't talked about it, but that you have space combat. I hope there's never going to be space combat.
Yep, but they put it in. There is an alternate rule where you can actually take that out of the game, where you remove the combat. You live in the Utopia rule set, I think it was. But I do like with space combat, the very first step of combat is you have to search for who you're trying to shoot. Like, space is big and you may not find them. So you actually have to roll to see if you can even find who you're trying to engage with. And then if you do, then you get to do this whole system of tactics points and do I shoot from a distance or do we get close enough to actually shoot directly? Bases are easier to find. I was a little worried when I saw, oh, if you do this thing, this is orbital bombardment. It's like, I really don't want that to be a real thing, but I can understand why they put it in the game.
Yeah, space combat is fun, right? But only in fantasy.
Yeah, I do wonder about it, though, because there's some pretty harsh limits in terms of how many ships you can support at once. Most factions start by being able to support 3 at most, usually only 2 crewed vehicles. And even if you invest all your politics points into it, you only get like 2 or 3 more than that. And so we're talking fleets that consist of like 5 ships trying to attack each other across the solar system. So again, we never got to this point in the campaign. We didn't have the 8 to 12 hours to get that far into it. I just wonder how that would work in practice, or if it's basically like, well, I'm claiming Jupiter and you're claiming Saturn, and we're just going to let each other do our thing because it's not worth wasting ships on this.
Yeah. I mean, if you just look at what's happening now on Earth, SpaceX has like 4 or 5 rockets that they can launch that are refurbishable, you know, and then if you add Blue Origin to it, I would probably say there's a good dozen reusable rockets out there right now that can be used and launched on a regular basis. So 5 is a very small number.
Yeah, I think the 5 limit is more for the crewed vehicles. So that would be theoretical manned missions going somewhere.
Even for manned, you know, right now, the Falcon Heavy, I think there's like 2 or 3 of them out there, and there'll be more. And again, once the New Glenn is ready to launch, you know, that'll double that capacity at least.
Okay.
What about space pirates? Are we going to have space pirates?
Yes, there's the part of the game that after a certain point of development, space pirates just spontaneously appear on the board.
They just spawn into existence.
Yes, they just appear. It's like no one creates them. They just start happening. They're like rats or yeet or mold or something. They just kind of come out of the woodwork or the space work as your economy gets sufficiently developed.
Who knows? I mean, I guess you can pose the question, is that a natural progression of we saw that happen here on Earth, and why wouldn't it happen in space as well, that you'll get some freebooters out there that start invading other ships?
I guess if the economics of it makes sense, then it probably will happen.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's one faction that would be able to finance that, but you know, if there's other Elon Musks out there that have a boatload of money hidden away somewhere, why not?
They probably spin off from the various bases you're supposed to be building, the disgruntled employees and such. It's like, I'm tired of working for the EU or for China or whatever. I'm just going to go off on my own and become a pirate.
Right.
Sounds like a legitimate career move.
So we'll have a black market sugar beet wine.
Now, what about near future? So one thing, there's another technology that only North America, I think, starts with in the campaign is the ability to get ships to Mars, like manned crewed vehicles to Mars. And I know I've heard about the efforts to get people to Mars, but I haven't heard a lot about it recently. What's the status of that right now?
So right now, it's all the purpose of the Artemis program, at the end of the Artemis program, is landing the first man on Mars. But getting there, you know, they claim they can do it in the 2030s. Not sure if that's going to happen because there's a lot of things that have to be engineered and designed first. So the plan right now is to get to the moon first, start building a base on the moon, and especially in a space station that will be going around the moon called Gateway. And then they will launch to Mars from Gateway. So the plan is probably to assemble the rocket that's going to go to Mars on Gateway, and then it will launch from Gateway from orbit around the moon.
That's so cool.
Which, by the way, one of the things I missed in this game is that these days there's a lot of missions that go to the libration points. So there's 5 equilibrium points in a 3-body system where you can, in theory, put a satellite there and it never move. You know, so between Sun, Earth, Moon, so on and so forth, we always have these 5 points. So Gateway, one of the proposals is to put it at Earth, Moon, L1.
Okay, that's the one that's in between the Earth and the Moon?
Between Earth and Moon, yes. L2 is on the other side of the Moon, and then you have L3, which is on the other side of Earth, and then you have L4 and 5, which are on an equilateral triangle between Earth and Moon.
And the benefit of these places, you can put something there, and then it doesn't require any fuel to stay there. It just is sort of held there by the gravitational interactions of the multiple bodies.
Correct. So it's, they orbit, so you can't really reach those points in practice, but you can orbit them. So that's what they do. They orbit these points. They're called libration orbits, Lagrange orbits, whatever you want to. So there's a few names for them. There's been some successful missions. Like, for example, the James Webb telescope is at L2, so.
Interesting. So how would we do that in Stellar Horizons? You'd have to have like places where you could send a mission or build a base, but it wouldn't be able to like generate resources the way other things can in Stellar Horizons, because there's nothing there. It's just a stable.
Yeah, you'd put a space station that would be supplied by whatever moon or planet it's orbiting.
Okay.
Probably the abstraction is that anytime something is in orbit around a planet, you could just hand wave that, say it's actually at one of the Lagrange points. The game has enough bookkeeping. I don't want to keep track of multiple stable orbit locations in addition to all the planets and moons and everything else.
Yeah. And by the way, it doesn't mean that you need no fuel to stay around Lagrange points, because L1, L2, L3 are considered unstable. So you do need some station keeping fuel on board.
Okay. Got it. So you need like minor adjustments, basically just to kind of nudge it back and forth.
Minor adjustments. Yes.
Okay. All right. So kind of getting down to the end of the game discussion, if you could change something about this game that you think, like, would you? Are there things that you think we could make this maybe a bit more accurate, or maybe things that they tried too hard on? Like, what would you try to adjust of the game to make it fit your vision of space exploration better?
Oh, good point. Good question. You know, I'm a little bit of an idealist. I would probably have tried and take some of the politics a little out of it and not be so heavily on diplomacy and have the countries work together better, but you have to roll for it. So that kind of that bothered me a little bit. And then it just, you still have to roll for engine failures and stuff like that. So you have a probability effect there that, yes, you have it in real life too, but it's not a gamble if a rocket explodes or not. It explodes because there are failures in the system, and it'd be better to maybe add a mechanic that there is, you know, something on during assembly went wrong or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds like one of those abstractions. I do know some of the technology can reduce your failure rate some, so that may represent superior engineering capacity.
That sort of, it bugged me a little bit, but I know the way they did that, I think it's still fine. It's still, you know, it's not game ruining or anything. I'm eager to play it with my group here, and still think it should be a fantastic game to play for space cadets like me.
And I imagine part of that is that you're an engineer, and so you don't want your hard-won engineering to just blow up due to a bad tie roll. Is that kind of a fair assessment?
Right, yes.
Or to have the politics get in the way of what you're trying to do.
That explosion was preceded by thousands of people dedicating a lot of time, effort, and love into designing this engine. And then having this random effect there is, I don't like it. Maybe just because I am an engineer, but yeah.
I suppose if you just decide we don't want to do that, you just don't do it, right? That's the joy of a board game. If you don't like a rule, don't use it.
You know, that's what I said in the very beginning. This game has lots and lots of levels, and I think you can add and delete levels any way you want to. I feel it's pretty flexible. So,
what were your thoughts, Brian? So we played this. We did a 3-hour play session, which is longer than normal. We basically got the world creamed by an asteroid the first time, but then saved it the second time. We got to explore a lot of the rules.
We went back in time. That never happened. Gosh, what do I think? I think that I've never played a game where you're rolling the percentile die so many times and so often does it not matter. So I do agree that those very low percentage events do take a lot of effort to maintain. This seems like the kind of game where if you're willing to dedicate the time and really learn it, it probably would be a lot of fun. But that 8-hour playtime, that's hard. That's a hard commit. I used to play tabletop war games. This is one of those. This is spend 2 hours setting up and 6 hours playing.
Yeah, my feeling I kept getting while playing is that I wish I had a computer to handle all the bookkeeping, because there's really two kinds of roles and stuff you're doing. There's the bookkeeping ones of okay, how much money do I get this turn? What percentile do I need to roll under? Oh, I'm moving this ship from here. How long does that take with my current technology, et cetera? And I really wish I had a computer to handle all of that little niggling detail so that I could focus on the important things of which planet do I want to explore? This probe is going to get there next turn, but I can explore at a penalty this turn. Do I want to risk losing it and get it now, or do I want to wait but have a less time in the future? Those, the decisions that I consider to be the important decisions, and offload to a computer all the little things. I think this would make a great computer game. So I didn't play Civilization that much, but I played its sort of sci-fi spin-off, Alpha Centauri. It reminded me a lot of that, probably because there was a lot of similar technology, some space exploration, the tech tree, everything. I've heard some people, when I was doing research, some people said that that particular game, Alpha Centauri, is considered by some people to be one of the best 4X games made for computers. And so I found a lot of similarities between that and this game as I was playing it, and wishing that I could offload to a computer the same things that I offloaded to a computer when I was playing the computer game.
One thing I would say is that price point for this, you said it was $120 at your friendly local game store?
$130. Although I did see at some point Compass Games was running a sale at $99, but I think it's back up to $130 now.
So that's about 2 times the cost of your average designer board game. But if you think about it in terms of time played, I mean, there are plenty of board games that have sat on my shelf that have maybe been played 3 or 4 times. If you play Stellar Horizons the whole campaign twice, you've probably gotten more value for your money than your average designer board game for most people. Of course, you know, there are some games you're going to bust out all the time and play a lot. But I think most of us have to admit that a lot of our games we don't play that often.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. There's a lot of replay value of this one. They have a bunch of scenarios that you can play, and you know, you can come up with your own. I think it's well worth the money.
Yeah, no, the scenarios I think are a good touch. So there's the defend from an asteroid one we played. There's the full campaign. There's one where one player is playing a rogue AI that is basically versus all the other human players. There's one where it's the shortest one. It's 30 minutes. It's literally, there's an alien spaceship. You have this much money. Figure out how to build some ships and go blow it up before it blows you up. That's it. It's a 30-minute scenario. The only world tile is Earth, and you get a pile of money, and that's it. So there's a whole range of things you can do here. I do wish there was a quick start, a little quick start for here's how you ease into the game and play, or maybe a YouTube how to play video, because the rules are very well laid out, and they're obviously laid out by an engineer. Every rule has a number. This is rule 2.6.5. This is rule 3.4. 4.7. And they're logical. They're logical in one way, but I think logically in a different way. So they're all logical. All the movement rules are together. All the exploration rules are together. All the combat rules are together, which is great for looking up when you're in that phase. But I think in terms of what's doing the action. So I want all the crewed vehicle rules to be in one spot, and then all the robot vehicle rules to be in one spot. And I kept having to flip back and forth to find it. I actually made little cheat cards on 3x5 index cards to give the rules for, this is a crewed vehicle. It can do this and this and this and this and this. And if I were to be playing this a bunch, I would actually print those out, make them nice and neat. So I had these quick reference because that's how I think. But I mean, There's a lot of stuff in this already. I can perfectly understand why they didn't do that. From what I read online, I'm not the only person who wishes things were maybe laid out a bit differently.
Yeah, I missed it. So they have the index, but there's no page numbers.
Oh.
But they're all numbered, though. So like
they are numbered, so you can go through and find it. But I sometimes wanted to... Well, but what a page, and you have to leaf through it and find the right number.
Does this come with a PDF version that you could search through?
So it's not that easy to find, but yes, you can actually download the PDFs from the Kickstarter page of all places. I don't think it's linked from the main Compass Games website, but the Kickstarter still has a full PDF that you can download. And I actually did that while we were playing. You may have seen me. I had my laptop open. I was searching for some of the rules we were trying to figure out, because sometimes like, okay, I read this rule somewhere, but I don't remember where. And there's 10 pages of rules to go through. So that searchability was very useful there.
Yeah, but I'd like to see a computer game for this one.
Yeah, this would make a fun app, actually.
This would be a great app. I would love to see that.
So we've been doing these report cards for the games that we've been reviewing that review like the science, how well the science is represented as well as the fun. And honestly, I was trying to decide if I feel qualified to grade the science in this game, but I guess I'll give it my best guess. I think this is definitely a game where the science was at the front and it was trying its very best to represent the science the best that it could. And I think that it feels like it's probably an A, like just for effort.
Yeah, I'd probably do that, like A minus. It's not quite as at the forefront as Wingspan, which is my personal bar currently for what a high science game is. There's a lot there. There's also, like Christoph said, some simplifications and some places where there could have been more, but there's not. But there is a lot there. And so, yeah, A minus range seems good to me.
Our actual qualified person, what? How do you grade it?
No, I would have to agree. I would give it an A minus. It's very and the where they simplified it or you know took some edges off. That's you know, it, to me it makes total sense. You can't go into all the detail nitty gritty in a game like this that's supposed to be for a broader audience. So yeah, A minus for sure.
It's so funny hearing that this game is not detailed and complicated enough.
No, that's a different thing. It's the science part of it. Next part is gameplay. I was thinking about this, and this is one where I'm split because, like I said, this is not my genre of game. So for me, I would give this like a B minus just because of how complicated it is and how much I wish I had a computer to keep track of the bookkeeping. However, for someone who really likes this type of game, I imagine it would probably be more in the A minus A range. I did do some looking online. Sounds like there are some very loyal fans of it. Some of them have kind of the same quibbles about the rule book or like combat being a little complicated. So it seems like for the people who really love this game, it falls again in that kind of A minus range.
I think I'm going to give it a B just because I think it's probably one of those games that is fun if you put in the work. And I don't know if I can. I don't know if my life accommodates a game like this, really. It was fun to play. I like playing the short scenario. I'm just trying to imagine the day that we would play the whole campaign.
Well, it's hard now that we have jobs and kids and other responsibilities like that. Like if I was in college, this would be much more likely. I could see just taking my friend's group is like, hey, we're just going to devote this Saturday to Stellar Horizons and just make a day of it, order some pizza, take some breaks in the game. I could definitely see that happening. But in our current life situation, yeah, probably not.
I don't have a family here except the people that I play games with every once in a while. So, but I would rate it a B. It's massive. It's very complicated. It's not a game. I prefer games that you can pick up and set up in 15, 10 minutes and start playing it. This is not that game. That's why I'm giving it a B. But fun-wise, I haven't played it yet, unfortunately, but I'm definitely looking forward to doing it with my gaming group here at some point. So that's just because of the massive, just takes a long time to play is what I say. I would give it a B.
Yeah, you said you were, but you got sick. So unfortunately, that was in the plan, but hopefully not COVID, but something.
No, not COVID. Just a little bit of a con crud.
Oh, did you go to a con?
Yeah, I went to MegaCon here in Orlando.
Oh, is that a gamer con?
No, it is a pop culture con.
Awesome. That's fun. I know Jason goes to Dragon Con all the time.
Yeah, Dragon Con. So it's just like Dragon Con, but except much bigger.
All right. Well, I think that's where we're going to wrap up again with the grades. Remember, these are just our opinions. So you are welcome to disagree and we are welcome to be wrong about it. If you dislike it, we actually have a Discord. You can come in and you can tell us how wrong we are or if we got anything incorrect. But otherwise, I think we'll sign off. Christoph, thank you so much for coming. It was great having you on here. I'm glad we were able to meet. If we do any other engineering-based stuff, we might get back in touch.
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. So that's where we're going to wrap it. So thank you everyone for listening and take care. Have fun. Happy gaming.
Yep. Have fun playing Dice with the Universe. See ya.
This has been the Gaming with Science podcast, copyright 2024. Listeners are free to reuse this recording for any non-commercial purpose as long as credit is given to Gaming with Science. This podcast is produced with the support from the University of Georgia. All opinions are those of the hosts and do not imply endorsement by the sponsors. If you wish to purchase any of the games we talked about, we encourage you to do so through your friendly local game store. Thank you, and have fun playing dice with the universe.